From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour will be made in the year 2027, when the teaching staffs at schools around the world will be replaced by robots. Well, that's a bold prediction from a British education expert named Anthony Seldon. And while some think his claim is unbelievable, others aren't so skeptical. Artificial intelligence is already making its mark in classrooms, including college courses, like at Georgia Tech, where online students often can't tell the difference between human teaching assistants and an AI teaching assistant named Jill. This is just one example of how AI could impact our future, and education is just one sector it could touch. Many worry that AI could be devastating for the job sector, with robots eliminating jobs, but others say AI drives human innovation and would not only increase jobs and create them, but increase productivity as humans collaborate with their robot coworkers. This summer, Tesla CEO Elon Musk said AI is a, quote, fundamental existential risk for human civilization, end quote. Bill Gates and Stephen Hawking also expressed concerns, leading many to ask, how could AI lead to our demise? Could it? What do you think? How do we find a balance between using AI for good and protecting ourselves from possible dangers? This hour, our guests help us understand AI, the technology, the ethics, and the implications for our future. Joining me in studio today, three experts. Henry Kautz is the director of the Institute for Data Science at the University of Rochester. He's also the chair of the Section on Information and Computing for the Association for the Advancement of Science. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Henry, describe your research related to AI for us.
So my own research is on machine learning applied to public health. So, for example, I have students working on with our medical center doctors on providing tools that can help improve patient care, such as predicting which patients will get infections after surgery. We've also done some very exciting work on data mining social media. For example, we're using social media analytics to find restaurants that are sources of food poisoning. That work has actually been deployed in several cities now.
Well, thank you for being here today. We'll talk more about that research. Darisha Kudetipudi, did I get that right?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Darisha Kudetipudi is a professor and chair of the graduate program in computer engineering at RIT. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And tell us a little bit about your research.
So my research in AI falls under two broad pillars. On one area we focus on is we build algorithms, AI algorithms that are inspired by the brain. The reason we look at brain as an inspiration is because we want to build algorithms that are robust, resilient, and that can learn continually in real-world situations. And we have demonstrated these algorithms in the context of speech emotion recognition and anomaly detection. The other pillar of my research focuses more on building the AI platforms or in computing platforms to run these kinds of algorithms. And we have some fascinating chips that we have built over the last year that have around six orders of energy efficiency compared to the state-of-the-art platforms in this area.
Well, thank you for being here as well. And Matt Unerfelt is a professor of information sciences and technologies at RIT. Welcome to you, Matt.
Hi, thanks.
And what does your research focus on?
So I focus on human-centered AI. So trying to understand how to create real applications that people can use that have AI embedded in them in some way, but maybe fail in unexpected ways, and trying to evaluate those systems with people to see whether or not they can actually still use them, even though they're imperfect. Mostly technologies for people who are deaf and hard of hearing.
Mm-hmm. I read a little bit about that in the bio that your institution sent over. Tell us how that technology works.
Well, one example is speech recognition technology. So we use that often in our cell phones, like with the Siri personal assistant. It's gotten really better in the past few years. So we're interested in using that to help people who are deaf and hard of hearing have meetings with their hearing colleagues. So they might have automatic captions pop up with speech recognition. The trouble is it sometimes doesn't quite get all the words correct. And so how can we present that to somebody so they know what they should trust and what words maybe they shouldn't trust when they're using a system like that?
Well, thank you. Listeners, if you'd like to join this conversation, you can call 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI. That's 263-9994. You can email your questions or thoughts about AI to our email address, which is connections@wxxi.org. And you can also find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. I'd like to start just by asking a very broad question. And I ask it because I was watching a video produced by Vox last night, and they addressed how AI has changed over the years. So the basic question is, what is AI? And the reason I ask is because the expert in the video said, when we had expert systems that fly planes, we called that AI. And then once it started functioning properly and we weren't concerned about it anymore, we stopped calling it AI. So what is AI today, Henry?
I think AI today is the application of machine learning, where we have very large data sets and we have problems that we don't know how to solve by ordinary programming. So if you look at the big breakthroughs we've had in the last few years, for example, in speech recognition or in Google image search, systems that can look at a photograph and tell us what is in it, those are all based on applying very general algorithms called machine learning algorithms to very large data sets. As you mentioned, the early AI was based on sitting down with an expert and painstakingly having that expert try to record the rules and knowledge the expert has. Now, there's still a place for that, but I think basically now it's really the data revolution is leading AI.
Mm-hmm. And how do we find a balance between how much we're allowing AI to develop? Because coming from expert systems that fly planes, that's one thing that improves our everyday lives. But there's some concerns out there that AI could take over everything. And we'll listen to a clip in just a moment that asks that question. But just based on your perspective, Dorisha, where do you find a balance?
As Henry was saying, I mean, I think what we have today is really a narrow AI or utilitarian AI, or what we can call it as pragmatic AI. It is able to solve a very narrow class of problems with superhuman capabilities in some contexts, but it is not able to generalize to other domains. So when we think of AI, or from time immemorial, I think we want this perception of having artificial general intelligence, which means that we want to have machines have the capability of human-level intelligence. So where we are today, we are able to solve this narrow domain of problems, but I think when we are seeing that AI is taking over some of these domains, we are thinking of artificial general intelligence, and we are very far from it today. So I think what we have today is a very pragmatic AI, boring AI in some contexts. It's running in the background when you're watching Netflix movies, the recommendation engines we have, or when you're selecting a product on Amazon, the recommendation engines there. So it is very pragmatic in a sense at this point.
Matt, how far do you think we are from AI being super intelligent, past the point of practical and pragmatic?
I think what you'll find is that folks that know a little bit more about AI really are generally not that worried about AI taking over the world with generally smart computers that do all sorts of things like this. I think the things that maybe worry us more are when people use AI in ways that they don't think carefully about some of the ethical implications of it. So, you know, whenever you automate anything, whether it's a human writing the rule or whatever, you're giving a little bit of trust to that computer program. Modern AI systems, because they learn all these patterns from data, sometimes we don't even really know how they've figured it out. We don't really understand all the numbers they've learned. And so sometimes it's hard to diagnose when things go wrong.
Well, let's listen to a clip from a TED Talk with writer and neuroscientist Sam Harris. He argues that it's only a matter of time before AI has potentially destructive consequences. So let's listen to this clip, see what our guests think, and see what you think, listeners. Here's Sam Harris.
If I were to convince you in this talk that we were likely to suffer a global famine, either because of climate change or some other catastrophe, and that your grandchildren or their grandchildren are very likely to live like this, you wouldn't think, interesting, I like this TED talk. Famine isn't fun. Death by science fiction, on the other hand, is fun. And one of the things that worries me most about the development of AI at this point is that we seem unable to marshal an appropriate emotional response to the dangers that lie ahead. We continue to improve our intelligent machines year after year after year. And at a certain point, we will build machines that are smarter than we are. And once we have machines that are smarter than we are, they will begin to improve themselves. And then we risk what the mathematician I.J. Good called an intelligence explosion, that the process could get away from us. Now, this is often caricatured, as I have here, as a fear that armies of malicious robots will attack us. But that isn't the most likely scenario. It's not that our machines will become spontaneously malevolent. The concern is really that we will build machines that are so much more competent than we are that the slightest divergence between their goals and our own could destroy us.
So that was Sam Harris. Matt, do you think he's overstepping there? Or do you think there are practical concerns?
I think it's an interesting philosophical puzzle, but I think he's overstepping a little bit. I think that folks that work in artificial intelligence appreciate its limits and are generally trying to find ways to apply it to specific problems. And I think at this point it's a little bit more of a philosophical endpoint. I'm not too worried.
Okay, Darisha.
I think a reference in that talk was interesting by I.J. Good. Actually, I.J. Good stated that if we achieve a chess-playing computer, then we have achieved human-level intelligence, because chess has all this complexity of generalization, reasoning, planning, creativity, imagination. But we have achieved that long back, but we did not achieve human-level intelligence on these machines yet. So I think we are far away from achieving that human-level intelligence, but there is an underlying assumption that humans are not going to evolve during this period. I think we will evolve with this technology, and we will amplify the innovation along with the machines in this process. So I think there is a lot more optimism from my end in this domain.
Mm-hmm. Henry, what do you think?
I think he makes several leaps that really aren't justified. One leap is to say, because we're making progress, and indeed we are making progress, it's inevitable that we're going to have human-like intelligence. And I think we would be very, as researchers, we'll be delighted if within our lifetime we see mouse-level intelligence. Maybe, I think, if we can get as far as ant-level intelligence, that will be pretty exciting. So the fact that it's going to sort of spontaneously take off, or we're very close to that goal, is not justified. The other is that intelligence is one thing. The kinds of machine intelligence that we work on, is that they have very specific utilitarian goals. They're not self-directed entities that want to ensure their own survival. So we can have something, a system, that is, can beat any chess player or any Go player, whatever, but it doesn't care about its own existence. It has no particular, reason to want to dominate, right? Unless we deliberately build that in. And again, we're still quite far from that. I feel like in some sense, the worrying about AI is somewhat like worrying about overpopulation on Mars. Like, we're going to get SpaceX will take us to Mars. We're going to start building. Then we have cities. Then we have traffic jams. I just think we're facing so many existential threats. And it's really clear we have this. We're going through the greatest extinction in the history of evolution since the loss of the dinosaurs. So ecological destruction that could mean the end of end of the world. Facing pandemics, we're facing a nuclear war. So if we can get through the next few hundred years of this, then I'm willing to start worrying about AI.
I think if Sam Harris were here, he might say something like, even if this human intelligence piece of AI is possible, but it's not happening anytime soon, if it's hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of years off, Shouldn't we be preparing for it now? Should we be talking about regulation and policy and safety now so that we don't get to that point in the technology? Like a seatbelt was created after someone got in an accident in a car. Should we be putting things in place now just in case that does happen?
And that's a very important question, Megan. And I think there are several researchers that have started thinking about these aspects. There are organizations like Institute for Electrical and Electronics Engineers, IEEE, which has recently released a report on ethically aligned design, where they have pulled in people from 13 sub-organizations to think about what should be the ethics in building these kind of systems. And there are several other organizations which have started this open AI platforms to discuss about these things. And I think one of the aspects that they bring in is, like, how do you build trust with humans and the machines, the aspect that Matt was mentioning earlier, and how do you make AI that is robust, and how do you build AI systems that use minimal resources? And I think an important component of this whole thing is that the human-machine collaboration, what aspects do we need to think about in that domain, and how do you decide when the human takes the lead, when the machine takes the lead, what kind of collaboration models can exist in this domain. So there are people thinking about these issues.
Listeners, I'm seeing the phone starting to ring, and we'll take your calls in just a few moments. I know there are a lot of questions about jobs out there. If AI might take over jobs, if they'll create jobs, we'll get to that in just a second. But first, Henry, you mentioned Go, and that's something that's been in the news lately. I'd like to talk about that for just a few moments. Tell us about what happened with the Go game.
Okay, so Google had a project they called AlphaGo, and the idea of the AlphaGo, Go had been held out as a game that, unlike chess, was just so complicated we could never really build a grandmaster system. So it was and even the people who worked on chess, really, many of them believed that Go was beyond the capabilities. So they took a different approach, whereas the success in chess was essentially based on systematic logical reasoning, being able to speed that up very quickly. The approach that Google took to Go is what's called reinforcement learning with neural networks. So the system would be essentially would first learn to play by watching games that were being played by a Go expert, then would start to play games against itself. And the really hard pattern recognition part was not explicitly programmed in, but it was learned in a particular kind of a representation called an artificial neural network. And it worked. It became the Go master, right? Now, after that, people started to say, well, maybe there's just something special about the game of Go that made it particularly easy, because Go involves a lot of visual pattern recognition, and was known that these artificial neural networks were good at visual pattern recognition. So just actually a few weeks ago, Google presented the results of a new system called AlphaZero. And what AlphaZero does is you give it any two-person strategy board game. You basically input the anything that you would play, so it could be Go, it could be chess, it could be, you know, other similar games. What they showed is that by simply self-play, it would achieve mastery. So what that indicates is perhaps the whole domain of two-person games, where there's no uncertainty, you have complete knowledge of the world and very clear specific rules, is one that is fully automatable. It's not something that really requires some kind of some kind of deep human-like intelligence.
So something I don't understand about AlphaGo Zero is the program allowed the system to become a Go master in just 3 days by playing 4.9 million games against itself, just rapidly one after the other. So is that relying on data that it's learned only from itself playing the game, or is there human interaction at all in there that it's biased in some way?
The first version, it relied upon training games from experts, but the current version, it's only on self-play. It still requires people to input the rules of the game, though.
Okay. So does that make you a little worried? I mean, does this play into the question of is AI learning human intelligence in some way? Matt, I see you shaking your head.
I don't think so. So, for example, you know, what would happen then if a pigeon lands in the middle of the Go board? What would happen if the sprinklers came on, or someone told a joke, or someone decided to start a limerick and ask the thing to finish that limerick, right? There's so many other aspects of intelligence and the human experience that something that's represented with a bunch of little pieces on a grid-like board is such a trivial sort of representation of. So yes, in these narrow domains, we can build great systems. And once in a while, they can seem pretty smart. You know, for example, there's a famous system from a very long time ago called the ELIZA system, which was a system that basically allowed people to chat and type in messages. And people thought the computer program was a psychologist. But it was really just looking for patterns in words that they said. And it would say back things like, oh, I'm very sorry to hear that. Please tell me more. And if you craft applications in a way that it takes advantage of the design aspects to convince people that they should trust them or that they're really intelligent, you can go pretty far with that. But there's a lot of limits.
So that emotional component, that cognitive component, doesn't exist right now. I have a question about something called affectiva. Is that what it's called? It's something Adam Frank wrote about for NPR, your colleague at U of R, Henry. He said the essence of the technology that affectiva pioneers is the ability of computers to recognize human emotions based on the activation of muscles in the face. Then the machine responds in ways that take the emotional state into account. So are we heading into a direction where AI can understand emotion?
We're heading into a direction where systems will be able to pick up on certain kinds of body language cues that people project according to their emotional state. They'll be far from perfect because even people are far from perfect. As we know, people really vary in our ability to read each other's emotional state. I mean, as I said, computer scientists are famous for their inability, you know, with how bad they are at picking up when the people they're talking to, for example, are bored. And so they go on and on and on and on. But I think there's a difference between a system that outputs, bored, excited, you know, interested, just basically classifying a person in some sort of set of categories, and actually understanding what it means to feel that emotion.
Okay, listeners, we can take some of your questions about AI, whether it's about jobs or healthcare or education, emotion. Any questions you have, any comments you had or have? Are you worried about our future with AI? Are you not so worried? Do you agree with our panelists? You can call 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI. That's 263-9994. You can email your question to connections@wxxi.org, and you can find me on Twitter at mmacmedia. We'll get to your phone calls right after our short break. More Connections is next. Coming up in our second hour, do students need school subjects? Teachers in Finland are gearing up for a significant shift in curricula where the subjects are all blurred together. It's called phenomenon-based learning. And that means students don't take math class, then science class, then English class. Instead, they choose an event to study that incorporates multiple subjects all blurred together. Will that work in the U.S.? Our guests weigh in next. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, filling in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about artificial intelligence, or AI, what the future holds for us, any potential dangers that we might see. And one of the big questions surrounding AI is about the future of jobs. And we'll get right to the phones. This is Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Hello. I think the whole issue of jobs, of course, is not an easy one. But I would think about the fact that right now, in the last several years, there's been a lot of changes. In fact, there's some discussions about people not being able to get in the end of work, potentially, which I'm not saying that's going to happen, but a lot of uncertainty. So there's discussions about guaranteed income. So it's not like this is something that itself is going to, even in a current situation, is going to just kind of all of a sudden one day get solved and go away. So that makes you think, too, about these issues. We're talking about artificial intelligence and relative issues to that. We are not very good in this country at planning large transitions, just to make it kind of simplified. And it would take a long time for people to kind of absorb even half of what's been said in this conversation, in this dialogue today. So that means that we need to be setting up systems. And our democracy, and one of the biggest challenges of this is how to use the democracy. And I mean, to the average person, not to the person who's just trained to do it. How do you implement, or how do you incorporate these things so that as you go along, questions can be asked? Well, what about this ethical question? And not just from experts, and I'm not putting down experts, but, you know, what about if this thing, if whatever is done that's new takes away 10 jobs? Mm-hmm. Are we going to let that happen? Are we going to wait? Are we going to do something way ahead so that we're not having, because what if you don't? You have a political consequence, and frankly, you get people like our current president. And that's not a joke. That's
okay, Bonnie,
reality.
Yes, thanks for calling. I'm going to jump in because he gave us a lot to think about, and I'll let our guests respond. Matt, what are your projections for
technology has been changing the way that people work for 1,000 years. I mean, we don't usually have blacksmiths that are making metal goods for us anymore. We don't usually have accountants who are working out the sum of a spreadsheet with pencil and paper. Jobs have been changing for years and years because of computer technology or whatever technologies came before that. It does accelerate. So the computing revolution has made all these changes happen a lot faster. So I certainly do agree that as a society, we do need to think about where we're headed. But there's no way to hit the pause button, unfortunately. Things are going to change.
Let's take a look at some numbers. So a recent Oxford University study estimates that nearly half of all jobs in the U.S. are at risk from automation and computers in the next 20 years. And then Gartner, a research and advisory company, predicts that within the next 2 to 3 years, AI will create more jobs than it eliminates. So there's some good news. It says 2.3 million jobs could be created by 2020 versus 1.8 million lost. Henry, what are your projections about the job sector?
I think we're going to definitely see disruptions in certain areas. I think one of the first ones that we've seen over the next decade that will be most disruptive is loss of jobs by long-distance truck drivers. Now, that may seem like a specialized concern, but it's actually one of the largest single sectors of employment. So that is definitely a concern. The larger question of where do people start working, that's not just about the technology. That's about society's priorities. So, for example, right now, even with a growing population, we also have a very large growing elderly population that needs hands-on care. And currently, society says it's really not, we don't value those jobs enough to give them a real living wage, right? Now, if I think all of those unemployed, you know, the same numbers that might be lost through AI go into those high-touch fields, caregiving, teaching, and other things. If society is willing to get behind that, I think it would be a net win.
Some experts are predicting that could happen as soon as next year. So robots appearing in people's homes with the ability to help them cope with disability and illness. Does that take a level away from just human compassion and care, though? A robot doesn't have that. What are some of the benefits and drawbacks of a model like that, Darisha?
So I think robots embedded in homes or in living aging populations that we are thinking of is actually a good sign, because you would want to have interaction, and intelligent robots or interactive agents can help this population in giving that interaction they probably will not have with their children on a regular basis. So there is a lot of optimism on that front. And whether it would replace the human emotion or human interaction is dependent on what kind of domains we are using it. I think in most of the domains that we are currently thinking about, it actually aids in helping or boosting the emotional state of the people. I think just today morning, there's a news article where university researchers from Brown actually are building this cat, a robotic cat, to help this geriatric population to have more interaction. So I think this is a good sign.
So I think one concern that I have is that this is maybe where I think the big fear with AI does hit, is the ethical question of where should we deploy it. So, for example, when you've got designing technologies for people with disabilities, you or older adults, you certainly don't want to replace something that they have now that's better. So this is something we think about a lot in my research, where we're trying to create tools for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. We don't want to replace any existing services that they have now, but there's still a lot of places where there is no service, where they might like to have a chat with a colleague in a hallway, and a system that could provide that automatically would be great. I think the same principle applies with older adults. So if there is currently someone who's able to give them that care, that's great, but there's a lot of people that don't have anything. So the question is really between that and whether a robot could actually be a benefit.
And I guess I would probably be actually more concerned about the ethical issues. For caregiving, I think it's great. For example, if you could, let's say, an elderly couple and one person is bedridden, to have a robot assistant that could help, like, lift the person out of bed, you know, help them dress, do those things so it doesn't fall entirely on the human caregiver as an assistant, so augmenting a human situation. But if a future where we actually say we're going to be getting rid of skilled nurses, or we're going to be getting rid of human teachers in order to replace them with robots, I think that's a bad idea, because robot intelligence, as we've been arguing, is just so far from human and intelligence. And people are very easily fooled into thinking that a machine, for example, is empathetic when it's not. I mean, you think of, you know, a little child, you know, talking to its teddy bear. That's not that different than, you know, an adult. That's essentially the same as an adult talking to a virtual agent. And, you know, in limited narrow doses, maybe that's okay. But if we end up with a society where the elderly are being cared for by machines, and the rest of us are sitting around talking to these synthetic humans that are not, that superficially are intelligent, but really, you know, lack human empathy, I think that that is a true dystopian future.
So it's not the scary looking robots we have to be worried about. It's the cute ones that are the sort of insidious.
Mm-hmm. Well, up next on the phone is a local teacher who has a question about teachers and robots. Go ahead, Zoe.
Hi, so I'm actually going to be a teacher next year. I'm just graduating with my master's degree in education. And I've been hearing a lot about, obviously, like you discussed, teachers replacing, or robots replacing teachers. And as you said, that's not a desirable scenario for a lot of people, but it also is, like, teachers are expensive. And we've been seeing people choosing or trying to cut out teacher salaries, you know, any way they can. So I don't think it's a question of whether it's not going to be tried, but whether you think it would be like a successful endeavor to have AI replace teachers.
Okay, thanks, Zoe. Stay on the line for a moment.
So I think in the education space, we've already seen AI helping us in online content delivery platforms like edX, which RIT uses. And most of these platforms currently serve as secondary platforms for content delivery or knowledge for students. But in the future, the way we see AI help in education domain is more in delivering personalized education. All that data we have from the learners, that we can use that data to kind of personalize the training and give real-time feedback to the users and provide smart tutoring services. But I don't see it completely replacing a human educator, because as we were discussing earlier, that empathy component is very important when you're teaching. And that personal feedback is also important for the students. So I think it can help us in certain domains where you could have this mentoring at large scale and accessibility of knowledge for a wider group of population, which is not currently possible. So AI can be liberatory in that sense, but I don't see it completely replacing a human teacher.
Zoe, how would you feel about collaborating with a robot in your classroom? If it could do what Darisha was mentioning, or maybe it's doing tasks that reduce your workload, like taking attendance or doing routine grading, how would you feel about that?
I think that would be great. My only concern is, like, another cost is the school building. So a lot of people have suggested, like, we've seen a greater move to online classes in the past decade, I would say. And, you know, that is a platform where 600 students are communicating with one teacher every day, where, you know, I would say that that's not the level of empathy that we want, but it's already something that's happening.
Mm-hmm. I'll let our guests respond. Go ahead, Matt.
So, I mean, there's a level of artificial intelligence and automation that's actually already something that teachers are collaborating with. So, for example, a lot of students write papers on word processors and have spell check or grammar check in their word processor. That's already serving as a bit of a front line a little bit in terms of giving some feedback to a student about things. There's already systems out there that automatically analyze essays that students write, and particularly on large standardized tests like the TOEFL test of English. Now, a human will occasionally look at these as well, too, but there's just so many of them that we automate some of that process. So there's a certain level of low quality, low trust feedback that people are willing to tolerate from automatic systems, and it's already snuck into our lives.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Zoe. Thanks for your call. Congratulations on graduating, and good luck to you in your teaching career.
Thank you.
So let's talk about equity in education. There are a number of initiatives globally right now to try to reduce the gaps in education across the world. Excuse me. In 2015, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization adopted the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. That's a plan to eliminate poverty through sustainable development, and one of their key focus areas is on education. And specific targets include completely free primary and secondary education, access to updated facilities, and instructions from qualified teachers. So if you're living in a country that is developing and you don't have resources to pay for a human teacher, is an AI teacher an option? What are the benefits of that, or the drawbacks? Do you think that's a positive or negative?
I've seen this happen in India, actually, where a professor from US actually has used one laptop per child, a very low-end computing platform, and actually left it in a hole in the wall in a slum, a very low-income group where the students, where the kids do not actually go to schools. And then he has left access to these different knowledge modules within that laptop. And the kids within a month has learned so much information. They were excited about getting access to this kind of content. So I see that these kind of opportunities or this kind of access would not have been possible earlier. And we could learn from how these kids are learning and provide better access to them. So I think it is giving that kind of universal access to everybody, because I think education is everybody's birthright. So I think AI has a potential to help us in that domain.
Mm-hmm. Matt or Henry, do you have thoughts on that?
I mean, I think we as a society have to make choices about where we devote resources. And so in many ways, AI gives us another option, another tool that we could deploy. So it obviously would be better if we had human teachers in all of these places. And as a society, we have to think about that as an option. If suddenly artificial intelligence possibilities come onto the market of ways to deliver information and knowledge to people, and it's lower cost, and that's how society chooses to address it, it's not necessarily artificial intelligence that has done something there. It's sort of us in the way that we make choices.
Mm-hmm. And I think another way to think about how AI can help with traditional education is the current model is you have, let's say, class for an hour, and then you have homework for an hour. And so that homework, it's like you and a book traditionally. Of course, students now, it might be you and Google trying to look up the answer. I think maybe a better thing might be that homework is you doing individual tutoring with an AI system.
We're moving into the domain of ethics, and that relates to an email we just received from a listener named Scott. Scott says, can you ask your guests how they, as researchers or programmers, can get an AI program to explain how it made a decision so humans can review the decision for fairness? For example, if an AI is used to decide whether someone gets a mortgage, can the AI explain why a family was denied a mortgage, income level or redlining or something else? That's from Scott.
It depends upon how the system was built. It needs to be built from the beginning with the idea of explainability. It's very difficult to tack that on afterward. Now, it turns out that the more traditional forms of AI that are based on these expert system rules are easier to explain than some of these ones that are based on just learning and pattern recognitions in large data sets. So it's actually a very active area of research right now. One of the biggest initiatives being funded by the Defense Agency is called Explainable AI, because obviously if they're going to follow the advice of an AI system in some mission critical application, it needs to be able to explain what it's doing. I'd say by and large, though, the way systems have been deployed for things like credit ranking and so forth, they've made it non-explainable and non-transparent, even in cases where it could have been made transparent. So, like for example, a credit score. At the end of the day, there's probably a certain set of attributes that it evaluates about a person to determine their credit worthiness. The companies, though, don't want to be too transparent about how they're doing it because they're in competition with other lenders. And so they don't want to reveal how they're making their decisions. So that might be a place for a government intervention to say, if you're denied credit, you need to be the agency needs to be able to offer an explanation.
Yeah, so there are researchers interested in addressing these biases that are occurring in the algorithms. So if you look at the data that was created, data is like the food for this AI algorithms, right? And if you look at the data that was created, all the digital data or most of the digital data that we are feeding into these algorithms was created within the last 10 years. So then you're inherently giving the data that is skewed to a very small sample set, so there is biases that are coming in from there. So how do you address this aspect? So there are researchers looking at actively at this aspect as well.
Listeners, we'll spend the last few minutes answering your questions that have come in via email and Twitter, and feel free to give the program a call at 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Here's a question from Sheila on Twitter. She says, will AI rely on networks? Will they generate their own power?
I think a lot of modern AI systems do require a lot of computing power, and this is something as a society we're going to have to really start to think about. You might have heard a lot about, Bitcoin recently, this digital currency that relies on somewhat expensive calculations called blockchain calculations, right? Well, there's been studies of how much electricity that's actually burning just to keep that digital currency working, and it's tremendous. And if you look at projections of the growth, that's kind of disturbing, right? So this is why there are a lot of AI researchers actually that are interested in creating algorithms to learn that are actually more efficient. And so it's not just because maybe they'll be faster because they're efficient, but they might use a little bit less computing power as they do so and burn a little bit less electricity.
Yeah, this is very close to my research area. We build AI algorithms that are very energy efficient. So that is why we look at brain as an inspiration. Because if you look at the human brain, it has about 86 billion neurons and 100 trillion synapses. And it performs about 10 par 16 synaptic operations per second, which is a lot. And it consumes only around 25 watts of power. Whereas if you look at our current supercomputers, they are consuming megawatts of power. So there is like a disconnect or disproportional increase in power or energy consumption in these systems. So if we are inherently thinking of building algorithms that are very energy efficient, and also once you deploy these algorithms, whether they're on data centers or clouds or huge compute infrastructures, if you can use AI algorithms to actually reduce the energy that is used when running these algorithms. That is something Google has done recently, where they got like 40% energy efficiency by using AI algorithms on their data centers. So there are two different aspects on how you could get this efficiency in energy.
We've had a number of questions about liability issues as they relate to driverless cars. Henry, do you have any thoughts on the future of that?
I think that's a very complicated question. I'm looking at one of the other panelists here. There definitely has to be a chain of liability. So, for example, when we build a bridge, okay, part of our transportation system, if that bridge falls down, right, it's somebody's fault. We just don't shrug our shoulders and say, oh, that happens. You check did the engineer do the proper engineering? Did the city planners do the proper projections about traffic? And you go through, and that's why we have sort of a whole professional licensing system. I would think that before we deploy driverless cars on a large scale, we definitely need to sort of have a clear, a legal framework for dealing with that kind of liability issue and the chain. How does it go all the way from the car manufacturer to the people who service the car, to the people who drive the cars, and so on?
There's other legal infrastructures in place for things like this. So, for example, medical devices. So you have pacemakers or other things that are deployed. That's another very high technology industry where people have created something that has a lot of little parts, a lot of things that could go wrong. But there's government regulations and standards on how things need to be tested. Nothing will be 100% perfect. But there's certain standards of how many out of a million would be a defective one that the companies have to obey if they want to sell products in that space. I think there's a lot of legal options out there, but this is something we faced before as a country.
Here's a comment from Joel via email. He says, one example of dystopian AI, San Francisco police using robots to drive homeless out of certain areas. So people are thinking, and we may see more ideas like that. Henry, in our last few minutes, what do you see as some of the major projections that you have in terms of healthcare when it comes to AI? I know that's a broad question, but based on some of the research that you're doing.
So I have a very optimistic view of the impact of AI on healthcare, that we know that our healthcare dollars are not being used as efficiently as they could be. And I think we have opportunities for tremendous efficiencies in the delivery of healthcare, in the follow-up of patients, of identifying those high-risk, high-cost patients who create a burden. So you give them extra services ahead of time so that they don't end up in the emergency room. So I think that AI will be a fundamental part of essentially saving healthcare internationally.
Mm-hmm. Matt and Darisha, what do you project?
So as I was mentioning earlier, I think one area where AI could really help is in giving personalized medicine for people. So we could have AI algorithms that continually monitor vital statistics of patients at risk or population at risk and provide interventions appropriately. Again, there is ethical issues that have to be addressed in this domain, but I think personalized medicine could help within the healthcare domain.
I think as artificial intelligence starts to be able to mimic many human abilities, I think there's a lot of really exciting possibilities for people with disabilities or aging adults who've seen a change in their abilities. If the AI can help augment or provide some accessible benefit for those individuals, I think that's going to be a really positive change for our society.
There's one more question from a listener that I would really like to ask in our last few minutes. We'll have to keep it brief, but this person would like to know, if AI systems become a big part of our lives, will robots be protected by the Constitution? We can laugh. We can laugh, but let's take Sam Harris's perspective and assume that, you know, they develop human intelligence and we're working alongside them in a way that we don't expect right now. What are some of those legal implications?
So I don't think they should be protected. Unless we start to extend those same constitutional protections, for example, to other primates. Now, some people have argued that we should. I think that even the best AI we can imagine is going to be more different from a human AI than us from a grade 8 ape or a chimpanzee. So now, if we get to a state where we want to extend it that broadly, you know, okay, but I think I'd probably go for the primates first.
Okay.
I think we're very far from replicating that spark of consciousness that makes intelligence a special and unique thing. And frankly, that's not even really something that researchers are really trying to drive towards in the field of AI. I think there's a certain line where folks reach that level of personhood, and I think it will be an interesting question.
Mm-hmm. Darisha?
Yeah, I think intuition is the highest form of intelligence is what we see, right? And we are very far away from that. And I think there are bigger questions that we need to answer before we think about rights for AI systems.
Well, thank you to all of my guests for being here today and answering all of the questions that you listeners have sent in. Some very thoughtful ones, some very practical ones. We appreciate that. And we'll continue these conversations about AI because, as Matt has said, we cannot slow the pace of technology or innovation. So we'll keep having those conversations as we continue. I'd like to thank Henry Kautz, the director of the Institute for Data Science at U of R, Darisha Kudithipudi, and a professor and chair of the graduate program in computer engineering at RIT, and Matt Unerfelth, a professor of information sciences and technologies at RIT. Thank you all for joining me today. Thank you all for listening. Stay with us. More Connections is next.